Afternoon. It's a tremendous honor to be here at CGI talking about this topic with this very distinguished panel. We've had an extraordinary couple of days already. I think you'll agree that we've had a wonderful introduction, overview, stimulation. And now I'd like to think, with the help of four practitioners, we're going to see where the rubber hits the road with our panel, where climate change and solutions emerge when you go global. And we're going to focus a lot, I think, on learning from lessons from around the world. But I wanted to start with actually a lesson from history. More than five decades ago, Mahatma Gandhi asked, how many planets? How many planets will it take if a country like India follows the path of industrialism that Britain has taken, that has already consumed half the world's resources? Now, of course, at the time, he was contemplating the fate of the great, newly independent giant, rising Asian giant India, and comparing it with the path taken by the great colonial power of the past 200 years, Britain. If we were to recast the question for today's times, we might ask, how many planets will it take if China follows the path of urbanization, industrialization, motorization taken by the United States, the great economic power of today? Or to put it in a crass way that is sometimes heard in the hallways, you know, what if every Chinese gets into an SUV like Americans do, right? That's the question on many people's minds. There's often a stereotypical aspect to this. We know already in this room, because many of you are working at the cutting edge of this field, that solutions are also emerging. Of course, the problems are real, and we're here today to talk about people working around the world with innovative technologies, business models, new ideas, fresh thinking, showing that solutions can also emerge from developing countries and places outside traditional centers of excellence. And that's what I hope we'll get also from the audience, your ideas. So without further ado, let me turn to our first speaker just to give a very brief, quick introduction of her thoughts. Lorraine.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. When we think about the idea of how does renewable energy and clean energy get deployed across the world, first, I think there's really three sort of buckets of ideas. And the first is often called rural electrification. I like to think about it as distributed energy, because rural makes it sound like we're somewhere out in the outback. But whether you're in the outermost regions of Canada or an island nation or in the developing world, the issues are the same. And I think it's primarily these four. One, that we have to utilize local fuels rather than depend on imported oil and gas. The second is we have to increase the reliability on renewables like biogas and, of course, wind and solar and geothermal. And then the third is how do we take natural resources that exist locally and turn them into biofuels? We're working on something right now on biodiesel, a great breakthrough we've just had for locomotives. And, of course, this can be for power generation as well as transportation. And then, finally, the idea of microgrids, the ability for a community to be sustainable off a major grid, because one of the biggest obstacles is the infrastructure and the time frame that it takes to put in some of these major infrastructure projects, both from a capital perspective, resource perspective, and then really to think about the payback of that. So a distributed system that would include all those elements can be very valuable. It also allows there to be more efficiencies. So there's less line losses. It's certainly faster to deploy, better reliability. And then, of course, it all can be locally managed and locally maintained, which is very important when we think about these big super systems where are the skill sets that will be able to maintain them. And then secondly, I never want to forget about energy efficiency. You often hear it called the fifth fuel. It's the easiest. It's the fastest to deploy. It has the fastest payback, 6 months to 18 months. And so, you know, we should always be thinking about the technologies that are available today. I mean, they are totally available today. 1 gigaton of carbon can be eliminated if we just had 25% more efficient buildings. And that's not a moonshot, right? That's a very easy thing to do. And finally, I think we need to think about new infrastructures. It's an overused example, but one I think really always hits home for me. Why build all the infrastructure for landlines when you can have cell phones and do that leapfrog technology that allows you to be faster to deploy, less capital intensive, and just as effective, if not more?
Right, so a call for micropower and megawatts from the world's largest and most successful industrial company. I'm sure we'll pick up on those themes. Let's turn to Harish.
Thank you, Vijay. What we think is we think that poverty is the greatest threat to climate. We are all talking about industrialized nations, but come to think of it, that half of India's population uses kerosene. That is approximately a billion liters of kerosene is burnt every month. 5 kgs of wood every alternate day is burnt in every house for cooking. These numbers actually do not even come under the radar of climate change. We talk about 20% transportation, et cetera, et cetera. Today we have created Apple iPods, et cetera, where you've not been able to create a good cook stove for a technology that has actually lasted from Iron Age, the three-stone cooking. So that's what half the world's population uses for good. By the time we come to a solution for them, it's already 15, 20 years. Nobody's thinking of the solutions for that population. And that's the greatest threat to climate. People using kerosene, burning enormous fuel, using cutting wood, the forests are going. Who is thinking of that solution? Look at poverty. One of the ways to remove poverty is income generation. Income generation needs some sort of energy services. That needs microfinance and then market linkages to the extra produce somebody does. The infrastructure needs to be built. It's not so easy to come up with a technology and say, we'll scale up. The other infrastructure worry. It's like a very poor woman in Bangalore. When I asked her, will you buy solar energy? She uses kerosene. She exactly said, 300 rupees a month? Oh, it's very expensive. 10 rupees a day is fine. Now, it's the same. We all talk about expensive technology. We look at how do you create appropriate financing to piggyback on that technology and the other infrastructure. Then let's not, then the poor can afford. We have 80,000 clients in rural India. Most of them earn less than $2 a day. They have never, ever asked for subsidies. That's what we have a joke in Selco, that solar is expensive for the rich and affordable for the poor because they spend more on energy. And we now need to think about those aspects of how do we create technologies, financials, and how do we reach to the doorstep of that particular client, and step by step. And then I think that one of the major threats to climate change can be addressed. And we need to address that today. And I think a lot of us are not thinking about that. That's the scary part for me.
Harish, thank you. A profound point about how the poor always pay. So they may pay through their lives, lost productivity, and many other ways, hours spent collecting cow dung or wood or other dirty fuels. And perhaps we can get into how we can put the bottom of the pyramid at the top of the list. Let's turn to Christine.
Well, I think very often in the U.S., the West's not interested in the problems that Harish has just talked about. And in China, we have the same kind of problem. In China, you could say that we have two worlds. There's the world of the rural poor, and we're struggling through the same kind of problems as Mrs. Kumar somewhere in India. Then at the other end of the scale, we're interested in high tech. We want to talk about CCS. We want to talk about things that you're interested in selling to us in China. And we're also interested in developing those technologies for ourselves. However, the language that we use to talk about technology often does not take into account some of the easier stuff, if I can call it soft technology. We talked about energy efficiency being the fifth source of power, but who is really working on shorting the problems that allow us to really do that? We all know, and I think somebody said it in one of the big plenary sessions today, that Japan is 9 times more energy efficient than China and 3 times more efficient than the United States. But who is trying to capture those efficiency in the megawatts world? Those are not going to be the hard technology. It's going to be about dealing with systems. It's going to be about dealing with helping decision makers, both in the private business sector in Asia, as well as politicians, to understand what are some of the regulatory and systemic and institutional changes they need to make to go down that path. So when we have companies like GE and others who are mostly focusing on the higher end of technology, there's a huge lack of time spent on using what we already have. So I think that's where I like to focus. And the final word is, when we talk about the soft technology of changing systems, let us not forget that communication is a key soft technology. So one of the questions that I have is, how can the United States and how can Europe help in international forums, whether it's business, NGOs, or political, to try to communicate some of these messages to decision makers? And please don't go on and talk about taxation is no good, you prefer trading. That's a very American-centric view. In other parts of the world, taxing carbon is fine, but it doesn't help very much for our leaders to keep hearing that carbon tax doesn't work, because in other parts of the world, it is much more acceptable to think about tax. So I'm not saying that it's wrong to not talk about, it's not wrong to talk about cap and trade, but Americans may want to modulate how you talk about that, especially when you're communicating with other parts of the world.
Great. Christina, let me echo your eloquent call for thinking about market-based approaches. As a longtime advocate of a revenue-neutral carbon tax, I've suffered many beatings and bruisings, because tax is a four-letter word in America, but nevertheless, ultimately reason will prevail. Moving on, President Grimson.
The discussion about climate change and this entire debate should really be about the future of energy. And I think it is politically much better to formulate it in that way, because we have all kind of headaches and hangovers from the debate in the last 10 years or so about climate change. But if most of the scientists are right, we only have either 15 years or 25 to 30 years to prevent dramatic, irreversible climate change. And it is a Herculean task to transform the energy systems of the world in such a way to make this happen. And it's very difficult intellectually, not to say politically or from a business point of view, to really comprehend and fundamentally understand how enormous this task is. What makes me optimistic that it can be done is the history of my country, which in the early years of my life was still one of the poorest countries in Europe, predominantly using coal and oil for its energy resources. I was brought up in a fishing town which didn't have a single element of clean energy. And we have transformed ourselves during my lifetime from being dependent over 80% on coal and oil to 100% of our electricity being from clean energy resources. And over 70% of our entire energy needs being from clean energy. And once we get the automobiles running on electricity or biofuels, we can achieve even more. And I don't accept the argument that Iceland is so special that it could be done in my country, but not in the United States or in Europe or in China or in India. And why do I not accept it? Because the history of this development in my country is that it was not done through some grand governmental scheme. It was done from one town to another, from one village to another, from one decade to another, through technical trial and error, setbacks and successes and failures, until when we add it all up, we have achieved this fundamental transformation. And I think the most dangerous thing in this whole debate is to try to develop some grand political or business-oriented solutions that will be a quick fix.
And rightly, applause well deserved. Let's pick up on that point, President Grimson. Those are fighting words to climate negotiators and others who believe in the role of public policy, in particular of international climate treaties. What do you think is the right role for government, even in the context of the bottom-up solutions that you advocate?
Well, presidents like myself and those who come from the political world, we are trained in acting slowly.
But not on this stage. You're going to give very pithy answers.
But the core of the business world is trained in acting quickly and effectively, and to use the mechanism of the market as the driving force. Without market-driven solutions, I don't think we are going to get there. So my view is this: the governments on the international negotiations are not going to solve this problem. It has to be a combination of the business and the corporate world and the scientific and the technological world.
Let's see what GE thinks about this, because I found it an extraordinary turn when a couple of years ago GE committed itself to Ecoimagination, a project that Lorraine heads up at GE, and Jeff Immelt publicly talked about, and very unusually for GE, talked about the role of public policy. It seems slightly at odds with what the president is advocating. Is business turning to government and government turning to business? Is this he said
to you. He's much bigger than me. I'm not going to fight him right here. I would say it this way. First of all, we're very active in the U.S. Climate Action Partnership. One of the early members of that and continuing, and it does absolutely call for legislative language and for action. Now, I think what the president is saying is that, you know, we need businesses to step up, and I firmly believe that, but there are, and so does our company, but there are incentives that can help technology be accelerated. It's incumbent upon us to do the research, to do the development, to make the products that are deployable. But when you have a product that is not quite down the learning curve yet, and if the, let's take carbon capture and storage from an integrated coal gasification plant, until there is liability language that we can live with, who owns that CO2 once it goes in the ground? These are uncharted territories. Governments must intervene. There must be some discussion about that. I don't think that we necessarily are looking for subsidies to actually do the technology, but for the deployment in the early years, we've seen this time and again. I mean, every nascent industry has some help from government in getting it started, and then it's time to pull out. So I think that's the call to action we see. Let's get a price for CO2. That would be the best thing to get these technologies deployed. And then where there are issues of liability and ownership and things like that, those are for governments to decide. And if that can happen quickly, I think we can get on those learning curves and have the free market just take over.
So a call for setting the framework, sending a clear signal to the markets that carbon matters?
We need certainty.
Right.
Businesses can't work in uncertain terms.
But if I could turn to Harish, you are an entrepreneur in some ways at the other end of the scale from GE. Do you look to governments in devising your business models and your distribution models? What is the role of the uncertainty that Lorraine talks about with your sphere of business?
There's no Indian government official here, right? In this room. No. I think the solutions lie very much within the people. At certain aspects, some of the policies will help you, but I think what we learned from our own experience, had the government been there from day one, we wouldn't have survived. Because irrespective of how, it's a very romantic notion that the government will help you all the way. It does not, because people change. Governments are not sustainable in a way that people change, and so policies change. And what we have found out is, as long as we can somehow create a business model, and for that particular business model to replicate and to scale up is what certain policies needed, then you go and influence a policy that helps you grow up. So that way we have done regular interventions. I have succeeded 2% of the time, but at least those 2% of the time, those policies have helped. But what we look at policies is, suppose we have done a finance for that small woman entrepreneur who wants 10 rupees a day. I cannot find any banker able to finance in that particular woman. So if there is a policy that goes down to creating flexible financing policies that matches the cash flow of that end client, and there is a target that the banks need to finance X percentage of money for those, just like India did in the agricultural revolution, that helps it. But we need to show the model. I won't really put the onus on the government to start with. But yes, as we go along.
And I think in your experience, we were talking earlier, you made an observation about the role of choice amongst even the poorest of consumers, some of the mistakes of the past of thinking of bottom of the pyramid consumers as putting up with good enough or standardized products. Can you talk a little bit, and Lorraine too, we'll turn to our other colleagues in a moment.
Yeah, see, when we're talking of the poor, we're talking of a need, and a need is very different to want. I want an iPod, I want an LCD TV, you can standardize them. I want an energy service. How many of yours dinner light table on your dinner table is exactly same according to your neighbors? It's very different. Your neighbor's light is at a different place. Exactly. Think of the poor, that every household needs different energy service need. We cannot standardize it. We need to customize it. Everybody's need is very different. I need a different cook stove to cook rice. I need a different cook stove because I eat wheat. I have a different cook stove because I have four people. I have a different cook stove because I have eight people. I cook on wood. I cook on coal. So that type of customization, we have not come to a point where we have enough models where we can actually scale up. That's where the scary part is as of today. But that infrastructure is the need, is what people should understand from the policy level. Don't do a very top-to-bottom approach that we know what they need. Get them up what is needed. They will find us. They are entrepreneurial. They survive on the streets more than you and me. We don't have a job for 2 months. We don't know what to do. They know next day. If there is a strike, they know how to come up the next day. Give the power to them.
And increasingly, I think we're finding that by listening to individuals, tapping into the needs and ultimately the ideas of 6 billion people, companies are finding solutions that they might not have otherwise. I want to turn to Lorraine and then President Grimson for scalable ideas that can be found not in the perhaps the traditional places we've looked for ideas about energy in the past. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with China, I think, where you have had some positive experiences coming up with ideas that became world beaters?
Sure. We've had actually two, one in China and one in India, and we call our activities there In China for China or In India for India. And the idea there is, in these emerging markets, which have enormous infrastructure growth, why not design the product there? Why not have it for that market so that we know that culturally it's a smart product, that it can use local fuels, that it can be locally deployed and serviced, and it's reliable for that particular area. So all those things that happen, well, there's an interesting thing that happens at the end of that. You now have this cost-effective product that's reliable and works and all these things. Guess what? It can be exported to the United States. It can be exported to the developed world. And so we have, in China alone, we have 1,200 researchers at our global research center in Shanghai. In India, we have 3,000 in Bangalore. And both of those entities are working on state-of-the-art, next-generation stuff in two different worlds. In China, it is they're actually working on integrated coal gasification, the ability to burn local coal. It's a very different thing. You say coal is coal. Why can't you just gasify it? It's a completely different technology. And so we're developing that technology so that the Chinese can burn coal and do it cleanly and to mix in with it biomass. So some of the most advanced technology is happening in Shanghai and with the cooperation of the Shanghai government. The project we're working in India is about rural electrification and microgrids, coupled with the idea that we can take wastewater and take the organics and things out of it that have energy in it, gasify that, and then have a closed-loop system on water. So think about, you'd like to have an industrial plant somewhere in a more remote location, but you have neither water or energy. Well, this is a solution for both. And that's coming from Indian engineers designing it for the Indian market. You know where the first application will be?
Where is that?
Oregon. You know, that Chinese province,
right.
Oregon.
In a similar vein, President Grimson, that people would not have historically thought of Iceland as an energy powerhouse for the 21st century. But I believe that you have strong views about how the technologies you've developed in your small country may have applications for dozens of countries around the world. Can you give us a very brief look at that? In particular, responding to the inevitable criticism or a question that, well, who has geothermal? Is this really going to be relevant? It's a small source of energy, which is almost the first thing people would say.
Yeah, that's true. People say that. And then we tend to forget that we are actually sitting on a huge fireball.
Excuse me.
When we...
You mean the climate change problem, of course.
No, I don't. You just proved my point. Maybe on the next cover of The Economist, you will, instead of the usual picture of the Earth where it shows the continents and the ocean, you just show the fireball inside. And it's that fireball which can be an enormous resource of energy if we play it correctly, as we have done in our country and are now doing in many different parts of the world, including China, including Russia, including the United States, including Europe, Indonesia and Philippines and many other parts. And the advantage of geothermal is it's the ultimate flexible energy resource. It can be applicable to one village or one household, to an aluminium smelter or a huge city. We are now in negotiations with China to go into transforming the heating system in major Chinese cities from coal over to geothermal. Because China, in fact, has such an enormous low-temperature geothermal potential that you can, in fact, transform the heating system of most of the big cities in China through that method. And by deep drilling, which is an interesting aspect of harnessing this resource even further by going down to areas of 400 to 600 degrees temperature, and even the potential of deep ocean geothermal drilling, as well as dry hot technologies and the Kalina technologies and many others, the technological advances in this area alone in the next 5 or 10 years could be a major part of the dramatic clean energy solutions for most of the industrialized nations in the world.
Well, that's, I think many people will be pleased to hear that, clearly, but also many people will be surprised about the reference to China. Maybe if I could turn to Christine. Christine, what do you think of this idea of geothermal and other technologies and energy concepts being brought to China in a big way? I know you had expressed concern about soft versus hard technologies, what might be appropriate, and then the softer aspects of this. What's your response, and how do you think this will play, given what you know about China?
Well, I think China or Chinese leaders are very open to any of these suggestions. And, of course, those people who are in this particular research areas, they're very expert in understanding what are some of the resources that China has itself that it can explore. The issue when we talk about China is, you know, a bit like India. We're talking about different parts of a very large country that has very diverse and different needs, and how to meet those different needs and using different methods. The story that the Prime Minister talked about that I think is very interesting is that in a country like Finland, your story of how long it took, you know, it was city by city, village by village, and then you string it all up together, sector by sector. I mean, in many ways, that's essentially what happens. Now, even when we look at the United States, it's taken a long time for your different states to fully appreciate what are some of the energy efficiency measures you need. So when we talk about decoupling, well, it's only really perhaps an issue that is being discussed more widely in the U.S. today, and that's taken many, many decades. So imagine that situation for other large countries like China and India. Now, smaller countries, I think, have the benefit of being able to short-circuit at least the community discussion, because by definition they're smaller, which is why I'm saying even if we're taking the knowledge that we already have today, the technologies that are already available, we're not spending enough time to try to communicate those as real solutions. Now, those solutions need to be understood by companies and businesses. They can, for example, adopt certain technologies and methods that are already available. And then, of course, at the higher level, countries, China's definitely interested to continue to invest and to work with companies like GE and other countries in terms of technology that still needs to be perfected.
We hear a lot of positive language from the leadership, and those of us that have had the opportunity to talk with them, certainly the technical level of competence and conviction is strong at the federal level. What about where the rubber hits the road, at the local level, in markets, after the SEPA visitors leave the town and people, you know, disconnect the scrubber? Or, you know, we hear the stories, and I know it's not the appropriate translation, but the old saying about how, you know, the mountains are high and the emperor is far, and edicts issued from Beijing are honored in the breach. How much of that is actually changing on the ground with the more bottom-up approach that we've been talking about today?
Well, I think if I was trying to use a U.S. analogy, is, you know, where you've got a good mayor or you've got a good state governor, they manage to push through more things. where you've got officials that are less interested in doing all this, and perhaps they have their own set of priorities. I thought Secretary Paulson described it quite well in China. The reality is there are some local interests who don't regard pushing these things as their top priority, because our regulatory, our incentives, and also within the Chinese Communist Party, promotional incentives are not yet set in the right way. Now, these are things that the national leaders understand very well, but to change politics, well, you all know here sometimes how long that can take, which is why I'm saying...
Let me stop you there.
Even when there are no elections, you know, where we come from, it can take a long time.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's an appropriately insightful note to stop our session. We're going to take a break and give you a chance to discuss amongst yourselves, and in particular, we have a question that we'd like you to contemplate, looking ahead in the spirit of CGI in terms of commitments. If you look to next year, what are the best commitments, the most evocative, unusual, interesting, meaningful commitments that your table can come up with? This doesn't have to be something you commit to yourself to do on the spot, but just brainstorming, thinking out of the box. Please think hard about what would be some commitments you'd like to see coming for next year's CGI. We have about 25 minutes for your discussion. We'll see you in a bit. Thank you.